It's February 19th, and I'm sitting with Richard Williams. Mr. Williams, could you tell me where and when you were born?
Well, I was born August 8th, 1920, in Binghamton, New York.
What did your parents do for a living?
My mother was a housekeeper. I had a brother and four sisters. My father, he was in the construction business and concrete business. He was a supervisor for the North American Bridge Company.
Can you tell us a little bit about growing up in Binghamton?
Well, I was a year old when they moved from Binghamton to Enwell. It was about 10 miles west of there towards Endicott, and it was along the Susquehanna River. And it was a bucolic environment, and every summer the Susquehanna River would overflow, and there was just north of where we were an old Indian burial grounds, and after the flood every year, it would go out looking for Indian arrowheads and bones that washed out from the Indian thing. And then I went to it was a good life. Interesting. I've always felt life was very interesting. I did then. I still do. We moved back to Binghamton when I was 14, and I finished school there. And then I went down to New York University. I had a course in dental ceramics, and I liked it. What I did, I had a talent for it. I liked it. It was very good, and I tried to get back to Binghamton to engage in my avocation or profession, whatever you want to call it, and the experienced people that was in the business there didn't want any competition, so they hired a ceramist from Buffalo to come in there and keep me from becoming established. So at that point, I went out to California, and I worked for a Dr. Williams, no relation. And he had the highest earned income in the Pacific Southwest. He was the best doctor, best dentist. He had a clientele from Hollywood and better established people. I remember Mrs. Post from the Post cereal people. He had to work on her, and he didn't want to work on her. She was so old, she had palsy, and I had to go in and hold her jaw when he worked on her. And I met George Murphy, Sandra Shaw, Gary Cooper's wife, Cesar Romero. I played tennis with Cesar Romero in Arroyo Seco one time, and it was a nice guy. And he had a car, and he picked me up and took me down. He wanted a partner to play tennis with, that's all. And in those days you could get a room and board for $1 a day. You had breakfast and dinner in a mattress, you know, it was a dormitory-like arrangement, but it was good, and the food was good, and the living conditions were clean, so forth. It was all right. Things were cheap in those days. But then there were two other guys living in there, and they were taking a PG course in physics at Caltech. California Institute of Technology, and there were Paul Saunders he was a Jewish guy, and I can't remember his name. It'll come to me later. And they were interesting. And one night, Paul Saunders asked me if I'd ever been down to Caltech. And he said, no. I said, no. And he said, would you like to see it? And I said, certainly. So we went down, and they were He took me around. They were grinding. They were polishing the 200-inch mirror that was going up to Mount Palomar, that had been made originally in Corning, New York, just west of where I was brought up in Binghamton. And then they had another room, and there was a guy in there, and he was had a one-way mirror that you could look in and see him. He was walking around, and he explained to me, Paul explained to me that he had been injected with I don't know if he's injected or how they got it into his body. It was peyote, and it gave him hallucinations of technicolor, and they were doing experiments to see if it had any ophthalmology application.
This is at Caltech.
Yeah. Right. It was a padded room where the guy, you know, they didn't know what was going to happen. And so I had I met all these interesting people. When I was over during the war, I was in Belgium one time after we got through Paris and dragging our feet going through Paris, of course. In Belgium, and I had a picture, it was a Newsweek, I think it was, and there was this story in there by George Fagan, I think, Fagan, and it had an article that they were giving him acknowledgement of his. He broke down the material that they injected into the German soldiers to keep them awake for two or three days.
Or amphetamines.
I don't know what it was, but it was. And I saw. I should have wrote to him, but I never did. I didn't. But I was very proud of the fact that I'd known George Saunders or George Fagan and these guys. And how I happen to know them intimately is that. Or personally, I should say, there was right around the corner from where I worked, an apartment, a two-bedroom apartment. One had twin beds, and one room had a full-size bed, and we got to rent that as completely furnished for $32.50 a month. So we split it three ways, and we lived there. And the woman that owned the place used to come in and cook meals for us and so forth. And it was great. And we had a signal that if anybody was entertaining a friend, they tie a necktie on a doorknob. So if you saw a necktie on a doorknob, you knocked on the door and you took a walk for a couple hours. And pretty soon, Paul... met a girl, and he was going to marry her, and he needed a place to live. So George Fagan and I moved out, and then I went back to Binghamton. No, well, I stopped in Nevada on the way. I met in this place I went back to after I left the apartment, and the same rooming house that I'd stayed at before. I met this ex-sergeant. He'd just been discharged from the army, and he wanted to go over to Nevada. There was some mining over there south of Las Vegas. At that time, Las Vegas was just a cow town. The biggest thing in Las Vegas in those days was a 20 mule team Borax wagon that stood on a train station. So we went down south. And we went in there. I was over there for a couple of months before I went back to New York. I just a gesture. Anyway, we ended up with a lot of dynamite and fuses and crimpers, and we blew the side out of the mountain there. And we sold the tailings for about enough to give me a fare back to New York. But it was a great, it was up high. There was a place called Nelson. It was near Searchlight, Nevada, where the present secretary speaker of the Senate lives, is from there. And it's Nevada place, and you get a breakfast. I got a breakfast at a restaurant there for $1, and the breakfast was a steak with eggs and hash brown potatoes and all that. We went down to this place though, where we had our mine and a hole in the side, and I had a sleeping bag, it was, you could look down into to the Grand Canyon, and at sunset at night it was spectacular. And occasionally we'd eat some they're very easily trapped California quail, and they're very tasty. And there was a woman and her husband lived nearby, and she took pity on me and used to bring me down. She said, "What was your favorite pie?" And I said, "A coconut cream with a graham cracker crust." And she brought me down one once a week. But it was a great experience.
How did you? What happened when you got back to New York? This is all before the war, then.
This is before the war, mm-hmm. And I got back to New York to visit my family, and I didn't know if I was going to be drafted or not. And they said, "Well, you might be."
This was after Pearl Harbor?
No, before Pearl Harbor.
Okay.
And so they asked if I asked them if I went up to join the RC at Royal Canadian Air Force, if I'd be exempt from their draft, and they said yes. So I went up to Hamilton, Ontario, and a guy took my blood pressure, and he says, "Go home and eat chicken, or go home and eat liver." My blood pressure was 90 over 60. I got vertigo by just bending over to tie my shoes. But I went home, and a couple of weeks later, Pearl Harbor happened. At that point, I forgot about going to California or any place else. And they weren't going to take me in the draft, so I figured I'd go back to California. But when Pearl Harbor happened, at that time, I was all set to... I went in. I volunteered. I went down the next morning, volunteered. They said, "You have a week before we're going to send you to Fort Niagara for your induction." And that week's time, we used to get our news for going to movie. And I went to movie, and there was a movie tone news or some sort, you know, this. And in there, they had this Tojo on his white horse, and he says, "When I get to Washington, I'm going to ride my white horse up the Capitol steps." And I hollered at the top of my voice, "Over my dead body, you son of a bitch." And they applauded. The whole audience applauded me. During the war, all I had to do was think of that, and that lit the fire in my belly. And I went up to Fort Niagara, and I was since I volunteered, they made me an acting corporal, and I was leading these master sergeants and list of non-coms that were being reinducted into the service there around to get their issue of new uniforms.
What was Fort Niagara like?
It was very cold.
Yeah.
You could hear the falls, but you could see it too, and it was all froze over there.
It was in Niagara Falls proper?
Well, Fort Niagara is nearby. It was a fort that was built in 1812. The 1812 war, because the British are coming down through Canada. Mm-hmm. That's where my outfit was in Plattsburgh, New York. If you there's an old stone army barracks between the Route 9 and Lake Champlain, and you can see that row of barracks there, and that's where the 26th Infantry had its initiation. My outfit, my 26th Infantry Regiment, I was a proud blue spader, and I was a proud big red one. And you made acquaintances in the service that lasted a lifetime. When they died, you cried. When I joined the Army, I was sent to Fort Lee, Virginia, to my basic medical training, and I knew more than they did, that's all right. I listened to them, and then I was there a while, and then I went down to Camp Blanding, right nearby here. I was set in there. That's where the 1st Division was forming, and there was three regiments, the 16th, 18th, and 26th Regiment. And I was with the 26th Regiment. I went in the regimental headquarters, and I was with the medical detachment there. And when you go in, you're assigned a bunk mate, and he's your buddy. You kind of look after each other, you know. You have shelter half, and actually you need two halves to make a full-blown tent. But mine was Bobby Cromarty. Bobby and I were friends from then on till he died. When he died, I cried. Today, his children call me, and they call me Uncle Dick. And I love them. And it was great. The people you met in those days were one of a kind. You could trust them. When I first joined the outfit, they got reinforcements that came in, and they were men that had been sent up from Panama, and they were alkies. They were alcoholics. And at the end of in those days, they got $30 a month, and that's what I got when I first went in for a month or two, and then it went up to $45, and then the end of the month, they didn't have any money, and they'd go through the tents. Anybody had any bay rum, or aqua velva, or anything with alcohol, and if just don't get in their way, let them have it. And they got rid of them because they would have been people that you couldn't trust in combat.
They were army people that were in the canal zone.
Yeah, all right, but they were in normal times they would have been discharged. Mm-hmm. But they kept them in for fodder. But they weren't even wanted in our unit because they could see that they were going to be unreliable people. Anybody that had that was in that manner, they didn't want them. Then we left there, and we went up to camp. Near Columbus, Georgia. We went up there on field maneuvers. We had live ammunition. Some of the mortars dropped short. We had 29 casualties in there.
During training?
That was the end of the training.
Wow.
Fort Benning.
Fort Benning, yeah.
And as a matter of fact, Columbus, Georgia last summer is where I went for the regimental meeting. And I saw Gene Cox and his wife and General. I see my old friends. But I'm not going anymore. Everybody's dead but me. There's one last guy that's in my outfit that was in my outfit, and his name is High Lilly, and he's in my story about my life because he played a role in it one time, but it was a very undistinguished part, and I didn't want to embarrass him in my story, and I called him Fred. Do you remember Fred?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this guy is still alive. He's down in Boca Raton. He's had a couple of strokes. He's in the hospital. I called. He married a girl from England, and I check out on him every so often, but I didn't have any. What happened with him was in southern Tunisia.
From Fort Benning, where did you go?
Indian Town Gap. We were there for about 3 weeks. We were near the Hershey Pavilion. They had big bands there every week. And boy, that was a great place to go and meet girls and dance. See good bands, no charge. And we were there 3 weeks. Then we got a 3-day pass before we left there and went back up to, that was near out there. Most of them were from the Northeast, from my outfit. I went up to visit my family and that was the end of that. And then we left from there. We went down to New York and Queen Mary. The whole division was out of the Queen Mary, and it took us 5 days to get from New York to Greenwich, Scotland. It could out, it went without a convoy. It could outrun a submarine. It would do 35 knots. That's almost 40 miles an hour.
You said in the book that it zigzagged to avoid
the sun. It zigzagged, yes. And that was one time I got seasick up there, sitting up on the top with Bobby Cromart, cutting cards for a dollar card. And we were in charge of the sick bay there, so that made it easy for us. But they had two lines, chow lines there, one in the morning, one at night. When you got out of the one line, you got in another one. And they had floating crap games or card games or something. One guy won $15,000 or $20,000. I don't forget what it was. They paid a guy $50 a day to match him, make sure he didn't get in another game after he quit. And he got to Scotland, and he sent that money home. He wired it home, and then later he got killed. So it was all in vain.
What was Scotland like?
Wet, cold, beautiful country, but it was the climate was bad, about as bad as Wales. We didn't stay in Scotland. We moved. They put us all on a train. We went to Tidworth Barracks down near Salisbury in southern England. And we were down there for a couple of weeks. And then they sent us back up to Inverary, Loch Fyne, on Loch Fyne, where the Duke of Argyll's estate was. Mm-hmm. We bivouacked out there, and it was on maneuvers there. We thought we was going to Norway because it was, it was up there in a cold country, and it was very pretty and all that, but it was not. And we'd get on a ship and out there that was in the Loch Fyne, and we'd have crap games going with piles of pound notes. In those days, a pound was $4. Today it's $1 and $1.40 or something. And when I was over there this September, last September, it was $2. But it'll be down this summer when I go over. And these English guys are standing around with their eyes bugging out, watching these Americans, how cavalier they were with pound notes. It was interesting to watch.
What were the relations like between the Americans and the Brits?
The soldiers were all right, mm-hmm. but the British people, there was an animosity there. They used to tell us, "Hey, Yank, we don't need you over here. Go home." And you're somewhat taken back, and it happened not just to me and not just in one place, but every place we went over there, they felt the same way. I don't know what their reason for that attitude, but that was there, evident, and that's the way it was. And after we left Loch Fyne, we was up there a couple of weeks on maneuvers, and we went down and then we got back on a boat, and there was a great convoy that left there, and it was three abreast, and you could see the boats from horizon to horizon. And we went from Greenwich, Scotland, up to off Iceland, off Greenland, down off the coast of Florida, and some of the boys threatened to jump over and swim ashore, jokingly, of course. That was a terrible trip, and it was an English ship that we were on, and they had. And the English food wasn't fit. They were good sailors. They know how to fight their ships. They were good. I was always glad to go ashore, have the English Navy with us, because they know how to fight their ships. But they were terrible housekeepers. And the food wasn't fit to eat, and there was even maggots in it. And they went up to the captain. They took the rifles with them, and they took a pan of stuff with crawling with maggots up there, and said, "We want decent food to eat, not maggot-infested food." And they, you got ice here. Why don't you put the food on ice? The captain says that ice is for the officer's mess when we get to Africa. by that time, we'd been told we're going to Africa, and it was issued suntans and instead of the ODs, olive drabs, and wool, and it was cotton.
So you found out when you were off the coast of Florida that you were going to North Africa?
Well, after we left to Scotland, we were told.
Oh, okay.
But it took us, I was under the illusion it took 30 days for a long time, and I had a calendar here, yeah. My buddy Gene Cox gave me a calendar, First Division calendar, and I had all the days that 26 was involved in, and it told our time that it was 13 days from Scotland. We went down off the coast of Florida, down off the coast of South America, across past Ascension Island, and up past the Canary Islands, and into Gibraltar, and into Oran. And that's where we went ashore there. And that's where we were attacking the, it had been arranged that the French Foreign Legion, they would have kicked the crap out of us because they were good fighters. But we were fighting the French regular army, and they're not good fighters, and they were Vichy French. They were there was a movie made about my outfit. It was called The Big Red One. Did you ever see it?
No.
Well, you should see it. It's good. Lee Marvin was in there. Lee Marvin was well equipped to handle a part because he was a rifleman with the Marines in the Pacific. And in there, they told it, they made the statement that the French welcomed us with open arms, met us with flowers. That was BS because they were shooting at us and meaning it. That was my initial combat. And I was a company aid man when we went up there. And we landed, it was a mountain called Jebel Majaja. Jebel is Arabic for mountain, and Majaja was the name of the mountain. It's like playing, the whole war is like playing King of the Hill. Whoever has the high point is in control. And we were overlooking the city of Oran. But going up the hill, you're looking down on a bay where the ships were lined in, and right at the head of the bay there was an island off there, and was going up the my first combat experience. All our first sergeants were combat experienced men from World War One. After that campaign, they sent them all back home, but we're grateful that they were with us because we learned. A guy up ahead hollered, "Hey, medic, I'm hit. And I was trying to avoid eye contact and look around and ignore the call. And the first sergeant says, "Hey, he's calling you out there." I says, "They're shooting out there." With that, he kicked me in the ass. At that point, I was more afraid of the first sergeant than I was the enemy. He says, "You get down on your hands and knees, crawl out there, grab them by the collar, and drag them back. We'll give you cover." And they laid down. And I learned, you learn. And I learned from that if you need help, you ask for it. And they laid down a field of fire. If I stood up, I'd have got cut in two. And I grabbed the guy by the collar. It was just a flesh wound in the guy. And I crawled back and rolled back and got him back. And I dressed his wound and, when I got back there and sent him back down the hill. While we were going up this hill, this Jebel Majaja, there was a French destroyer that came in around from Oran. He would get around that island, and if he had been turned loose in there, all our ships were just offloading from there. That's where we landed. That was our invasion point. And he got in there, and he would have had a free, it'd been like shooting fish in a barrel. Pardon me. And somebody must have been on the radio to a British destroyer that was down the coast, and he came up from the west and at full bore. I mean, he come in right there, and he swung around in coming the entrance and got that French destroyer between him and the island. And there was an exchange of salvo there, and the French destroyer lowered its flag. I can see it to this day. I haven't forgotten anything. I remember it all, and it was a great show. It was just like a movie, the French destroyer dropped its flag. Then it made the fatal mistake of opening up on the British destroyer. And with that, the British destroyer opened up with everything it had. I think even small arms. And they must have, one of their, I mean, it pounded into there and it must have hit the magazine amidship there, the where the armaments were. And it blew the ship up, and the bow and astern went up and down it went.
So the French fired after they lowered their flag.
Right. Hmm. And I saw them later. We got up the top of the hill there that night, and it was dark, and there was a Neeson hut up there, and I went in there to lay down, and I could feel something wet in there. I didn't know if somebody, what had happened, what it was. You try to avoid things you can't identify with. You don't light any fire matches or anything. And the next dawn, when dawn came out, I looked over there, there was a guy with his brains out laying in there. And so I got out. We went down to Oran, and I saw some of those guys, a few survivors from the French destroyer, and they weren't too happy to see us, but we saw them in there. And then we were bivouacked out in the field. It was a field. Bobby Cromarty and I pitched our pup tents out in the field, a cauliflower field. I learned to eat cauliflower, raw cauliflower. It was delicious. And muddy as hell. Oh God, it was a mess. And then they took us. There was some coastal along the coast. There were summer homes for the well-to-do French there, and they put us in there to get cleaned up before we went on up to Tunisia. When we was in there, we went downtown. And they had a brothel there. It was three stories high on one street. The girls in there, they were European. I suspect that there were probably white slavery going on there. But anyway, the French had it in an afternoon, and we had it in the morning. But anyway, or something like that. But we got at the end of the line there, and there's guys lined up to go in there and get laid. And there's some English guys at the end of the line there say, "I see these Yanks, you know, disgusting, aren't they?" Yeah, but they were standing there at the end of the line waiting to go in and get laid. And so Bobby and I, we said, "The hell with this, let's go downtown and see if we can find any streetwalkers." But hey, anyway, we went down, walked around, no girls, but we found a gym. And a real nice gym, and we went in, and we had a swimming pool, and you got a complete workout and a rub down there with the Arab girl. We tried to put the make on the Arab girl. And those guys had their eye on us, you know. Anyway, we felt good anyway, but we forgot. We went back to where we're bivouacked or where we're staying in these places. And on the way, we passed this whorehouse, and there's guys still lined up. Bobby and I said, "Let's go inside. We'll put our brassards on." And we had a Red Cross brassard. We put them on our arm. When they said, "Okay, medics coming through." And we walked up the stairs, three flights, and we got up there. And here's Gerolf. This is something that it was the most repulsive thing I ever saw. Girls that were lying spread eagle on the bed, money in their hand, fluid running out of their crotch, and guys still lined up to do business with them. Bobby and I said, "Let's close this place down." So we looked at it. We said, "Okay, boys, that's all. Go home." And that was the end of it. We went down, we looked up the officer of the day, and he was a captain. We chewed him out for we told him what we closed the place down, and we gave that officer hell. The next day I looked up the colonel and told him the story, and he says he should be reprimanded. I said, "That's why I'm telling you about it."
Did the Army have regulations about venereal disease?
Oh, they had prostations. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That were men would go and they inject stuff in themselves and wipe this ointment around and keep you from getting venereal disease or so other things. It was a yes. When I was down in Tidworth Barracks, I went to, when I was a young boy, I was a virgin until I was 21. And how that happened is that, when I was in Binghamton, there was a hill that I lived on, a street called Pennsylvania Avenue. You could go up there for about 5 miles, uphill all the way, and I had my bicycle, and I'd go up there, and there was a fountain I could get a drink at, and it was delicious. And I'd rest a while, and then I would pump down. I would pump all the way down, and I was getting intoxicated from the oxygen, I guess, and I'd sing Dixie or anything. I felt real elated, and it was great. And that was a routine I went through for until this girl followed me up one night, and she must have been watching me, and she wanted to do business, and I was still a virgin, and I think I was 16 or 17, and anyway, I tried to do business with her, but she still had her hymen, and it was intact. It was hurting me, and I couldn't see any fun in that, and I said, to hell with it, and I left. I was frustrated, of course. And I got on my bike and pedaled down the hill, and I got down there, and my father was out in front of the house. He said, did you touch that girl? Her parents were up looking for her. I said, no, I didn't. And he said, you better not have. She came down, and I guess they examined her and found out she was still a virgin. And her old man, instead of apologizing to me, nothing. He said nothing. So anyway, I was slow moving towards sex until I got to Tidworth Barracks, and I had a pass to London. And it was during a blackout, and this prostitute was there. She wanted £2. A pound was $4. And she probably would have taken a pound, but I got nervous, and I gave her £3. And it was the worst thing I ever had. And there was a guy standing out there, and it was a blackout during the nights in London. And this guy was out, pipers, conundrums. Pipers, conundrums, that was my initiation to sex, and I ran away quick to find a pro station so I could get out of scared. I was going to get very near. That was my initiation to sex, and I said, if that's the way it is, I'll never pay for it again, and I never had to. I was a pretty good-looking guy in those days, and I didn't pay for it.
So going back to Tunisia, what happened after?
Well, we left. Oran in a convoy, and as was going up there, we went through the city of Orleans. It was a walled city, an old city. I don't know. They've changed the name of it now, but the convoy slowed because you had to go. The entrance was very narrow. The trucks had to move slowly through it so they didn't take off their side of the truck. And as we're sitting there waiting to go through these entrances, there's a line of people there. And there was a boy in the line, and he was, all these people were right out in daytime, and this kid was masturbating.
In the street.
Huh?
In the street.
Right in the street. Right in front of the French people were standing there. It was a madam, easy. That was quite a spectacle. And then later on, we got up to, we bivouacked on the way up after we got through. We went through a place called it was a walled city. No, it wasn't a walled city. It was a city on a hill, and the rock, the big. It was a big rock, and it was split at the top, and it was Constantine, a beautiful place. And down below there was a swimming pool, a big Olympic-sized swimming pool from natural springs water, and we bivouacked near there. But one of the one time we was out in the mountains, and we bivouacked, and this mortar company got drunk on this red wine they had. It was pretty liberal in those days, and they're cheap and everything, but I didn't look for it. So, but anyway, we got, and they zeroed in, these guys got, and there was a little Arab stone settlement nearby. They weren't bothering anybody. There was probably 35, 40 people, all one family probably in there. And they, and they zeroed in on there with their 81 millimeter mortars. And I had to go over and clean up after them. And I, later we got to Tunisia. They had a hearing. And I had to go in and testify about it. But they could, all, the whole company was condemned.
They fired on the Arabs.
Yeah.
They're
civilians.
Yeah.
Let's talk about My Lai out in Vietnam. We did it there. We didn't condone that.
So they were drunk and they were
firing. Yeah, they were drunk and they were zero. They were shelling these Arabs. We didn't approve of that. Most people didn't.
What happened to them?
Well, I don't know. They got court-martialed. They got penalized. I guess I don't know. Hmm. They never could find out the exact men. The whole company was condemned. They could. They had no. I don't know. They what their punishment was. They probably had to pay for it. Hmm. And they should have.
What were the relations like between the French and the Arabs?
The French between the French and the Arabs were like. Like it was the Africans down south here and the whites. They subjugated the Arabs and when they eventually kicked the French out, I understood what was going on, and they were intelligent people, and the French had misused them, and I didn't blame them for what they did. They were intelligent. You know, a guy would come up. They wore baggy pants. They had pants down. The crotch was down to their knees. As we understand it, we were told that the Allah was going to be born from a man. all religions have their idiosyncrasies, and that was one of theirs. And anyway, this guy comes up and we want to buy, he pulled out an egg out of his pants. Well, the going price for an egg in those days, and that was a desired commodity. And he pulled out this egg and he wanted 3 francs, and the going price was 2. And so, well, it's only one egg, so we paid him the 3 francs. And then he pulls out more, and he ends up with a couple of dozen eggs in his pants. So he got, you can tell, yeah, they're pretty smart people. And it was interesting. And they had meat hanging outside, you know, black from the flies. If we had eaten it, we'd probably got poisoned, got been sick to but they ate it and survived. So, that was there. But they were oppressed by them. But there were some wild-eyed guys that would go and rob and steal from the after the Germans left up in Tunisia, and the French rounded them up. They'd round up all the Arabs in the town and shoot all the men. And this happened in Gafsa.
All of the men?
Yeah.
Not just the ones that were stealing?
No. Wow. They just lined them up. They wanted us to join them. And America said, no, we don't do that. And that's how the French treated the Arabs. And when the Arabs kicked the French out, I understood what they were doing. I believe them. Didn't blame them. But they were the French that were... around there were Vichy French. Mm-hmm. They were Nazi sympathizers. Northern France, Normandy, and up Paris, and up that way, from there, from Paris over to Belgium, like that. Though they were not Vichy French, and they were normal. They were not sympathetic to the Germans. They didn't want the Germans. They didn't like the Germans, and it was interesting. relationship there.
So the convoy arrived in the city. What happened after that?
Well, we took up quarters there. We had there was some paratroopers that went up first to clear out. There was a German garrison there. They were ahead of Rommel. Rommel was coming around from Libya. It was coming up along the Mediterranean. Montgomery was chasing them west, and they were coming up that way, and they had an advance guard up there. And our paratroopers went in there and cleaned them out. I went from Gaston down to El Guitar. And El Guitar, there was an old French Foreign Legion encampment there. It looked like something out of Bogest. A beautiful thing. You know, undefensible. I mean, my God, an artillery would just crumble the thing. But it was for a rifle, you know, it was garrison for the French Foreign Legion. And we were there, and I had to go back to Gaston to get some medical supplies. And when I was back there, I was heating it in the winter time in the desert, it's cold. And I was heating up a can of coffee and a canteen cup over a can of Sterno. And here comes this Jeep up with one star on there, and we all knew who the hell that was. That was Teddy Roosevelt Jr., boy, and that was our, and we, that didn't have to be told. We got up and threw him a salute there, and he looked and sounded just like his father. He said, "Coffee ever tastes better when it's cooked out in the open." "That's right, General. Would you like a cup?" "Don't mind if I do." And he came over and sat on his heel. I gave him my cup. He drank half, and I finished the other half. So I had the honor of sharing a cup of coffee with my hero, Teddy Roosevelt Jr. and I loved it. So we was out there, and pretty soon we had to leave there. Rommel was coming up there, and it was going to cut us off. And we had it was a 50-mile trip from El Guitar to Gafsa to Tabessa. Tabessa was the focal point. It was just inside of Algiers, and we were on. That afternoon at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock, we had mail come in, Christmas presents, Christmas cards, and then at 6 o'clock, they said, "What you can't carry," they decided they're gonna have to, we were retreating. They call it a strategic withdrawal, but we were retreating. Rommel was coming around, we were exposed. It was just a small cadre of us out there. And so we loaded up our trucks. All the trucks were loaded up, and there were girls along the road there that had been in this place down in El Guitar where they're doing business. I saw them in town in Tabessa the next morning. So somebody got a ride that night besides on a truck. And anyway, it was 50 miles. Bobby Cromarty and I loaded what we could. Brought our stuff. We had our backpack and shelter hats and so forth. So we got on top of the truck, hung on. They were loaded right up. And they had a big bonfire there. All the provisions. We had been eating sea rations like hash, dog food. You know, not very good. And here they had K rations. That was a compost meal with vegetables or fruit, fresh fruit in cans and like that. And then all that goodies went on this big bonfire that they were going to destroy. They couldn't take with them. Didn't want to leave it for the Germans. So they destroyed all that. We spent all night on this goddamn truck going into Tabessa. And I got to get a drink. Mm-hmm. Was a Kasserine, the men were going, we were going up there to clean out the Germans and Italians that had been in there. And we had a company of Rangers with us, 200 men, and they went up there and they cleaned them all out. not a, there were 1,000 Germans and Italians up there in Kasserine Pass, and they cleaned them all out. They came back the next morning, not a man wounded, not a scratch. They killed them to a man. And who's standing there but Patton? And they didn't have ties and leggings on, and he gave him hell. Instead of congratulating, good job, good show, man. Congratulations, you did a good job. He gave him hell because they didn't have ties and leggings on. I'm glad he was on our side, but I, as a man, he stunk. Mm-hmm. I didn't think much of Pat. It was a my. So at Fayed, we got to, the next morning, there was going to be a full engagement, and we had a forward artillery observation post, and this is where Fred comes in, and I had the musette bag, I was a doctor, and Fred had the litter. We were going to carry this guy out. He was wounded. He went outside to relieve himself, and when he squatted down, a shell had burst near enough to a fragment of the shell cut off one of his testicles. And so when I got down there, he was in a lot of pain and so forth, and I put a compress and I like a diaper on him. I gave him a shot of penicillin, morphine, and I said, my litter bearer is gone. I got to go back, get another litter squad and come back to get you. And, when I was on the way down there, it was about a mile and a half or so. I don't know. It's a little ways down, and flares go off. When a flare goes off, you freeze. You don't move. And here's this goddamn line of guys right over on a hill there. They're out on a night patrol. I don't know if they're Americans. They probably were, because they were right on top of the ridge. If I'd have been in charge of them, I'd have said, get on either side, and we'll meet at the bottom. But you don't expose yourself for that reason. And I ought to have made a good platoon leader. And these guys were all there exposed. So when the flare dies out, and then you proceed on down, you close your eyes so that you're not going to be too blinded when you don't start right away, or you stumble, you couldn't see things. But I got down there and I take the guy. And as I was leaving to go back to get another litter squad, this kid come down, he reinforced when he'd been down there in this forward artillery observation post. Hey, mister, take me with you, will you? I'm going to get killed here. I can't stay here. My God, it was repulsive. Stupid. Terrible. I have no tolerance for a coward. And he was a coward. And I said, hey, stop your whining. I got a job to do, and you got a job to do. Go do your job. And if you want to feel good, go and ask your boss if there's anything you could do for him, and then do it willingly. I said, make you both feel good. I said, stop the whining. I'll see you when I come back. I never saw him again. But anyway, after that, I went back. I got another litter squad. I went down. I got the guy out. I got him out just about the time the artillery started opening up, just before dawn. And I got the guy out. I was recommended for the Bronze Star for that. The next day they asked me, what happened to Fred? And I said, well, I guess we all know what happened to him, but you can put down that he got lost. What are you going to say, huh? Mm-hmm. You know, he's a coward. So that took care of Fred. So we got out late. Later, we were up in Lakef, northern Tunisia, and had a tank battle there. And we go in right after the tank ceased firing, and they're all your sides. The artillery takes care of them, and the Germans had those Mark 6s. Oh God, they were Tiger tanks. they had 88 millimeter rifle on there, and they'd shoot a trajectory, straight trajectory for miles. And they were deadly accurate. And we got up there, and here's these tanks. And so they're not moving, and where you go up, climb in, and see if there's any wounded or any guys. If they're all right. And anybody wounded here? No sound. You push the guy, and he crumbles. He's just ash. They're burned. And another time I went up, I had to go back, get some medical supplies. There's a mountain. And I could go around the mountain, and it was about 3 miles. Or being a lazy guy, I went over the mountain. There was no cover, there's no rocks, no shrubbery, no nothing. And I get almost up to the top, and bang, right between me and the top, a shell breached. And I look back, I can't see any smoke. So I knew it was a German 88, and they had me targeted. And I made a mad dash. I threw myself over the top of the hill, and Jesus, just as I did that, another shell breaks. Right where I peeked over, right where I was standing. Mm. Needless to say, when I went back, I went around the mountain. Oh my. Why I'm here, I don't know, and I don't care, but I'm enjoying life, and I think it's great. And the most beautiful country I saw over there, and a place I'd like to see again, but I never will, is northern Tunisia, along the coast from there to Algeria. It's cork forests, wheat fields, wild boars, they had some briar trees, and the roots of those are growing just out on the ground, like, and the guys take hacksaws and cut them off, make pipes. They have nothing else to do, so they make some real fancy looking pipes there, and it was interesting. It was a beautiful place there, and a lot of Roman ruins, old ruins, more ruins there than any other place. Sicily too, but that's another story.
Do you want to end there?
Yeah, that's enough.
Okay, all right.